This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Let's just have a look. So what is the Medrash saying? So this is the Medrash, for the sake of the tape recording, I'm just going to quote the where we are. So we're in Medrash Rabbah Parsha Yud Zayin, and we're on Medrash Vov, where Rabbi Chanina Breid Rabbi Idi says that we don't find a samach from the beginning of the Sefer until now. This is the first time that there's a samach. Vayisko boso tafteno. He closes up the flesh beneath the ribs from which he took the rib, or the side, as the Medrash also wants to learn. And we've said the sound samach is a negative phonetic sound. Samach stands for Sotan, phonetically, not alphabetically. Alphabetically it's the sin, but phonetically it's the samach. The samach is the archetype of the phonetic sound of s. And also the word bayiskor, because what does bayiskor imply? Close. And what's that got to do with the Sotan? The Sotan actually closes off options. And we'll perhaps talk about that a little bit further on. So yes, you found the Medrash disturbing, because the Medrash tells us until the woman was created, there was no place for the Sotan to work. He couldn't have operated without the woman being present. We see that in the continuation of the story. If there wasn't Chava, then the snake wouldn't have had a chance. But it's a lot more than just that story. We're seeing here that in the creation of Chava is the creation of the Sotan. So we'll have to go into some understanding of what the creation of the Sotan is, what the Sotan is. And secondly, we need to appreciate then that was fully intentional on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that he obviously knew, as he would create women, that with that he was creating the Sotan. And yet he said, Hashem was the one who said, Lo tov heyoso adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. So what does that mean, that Hashem isn't saying it's not good for man to be without a Sotan? And what is that? What is the woman's role in all of this? That we'll have a look at in a moment. But before we do, I would like to look at one further Medrash, which is in that same column, further down the line, three lines from the bottom of that column. Maaseh bechosid echad. Have you got that? There was a... three lines from the bottom of that paragraph. Maaseh bechosid echad. There was a story about a particular chosid, who was married to a chassido. And of course, in those days, that doesn't mean a chassid in the sense of the way the word is used today. It means a righteous man married a righteous woman. An exceptionally righteous man married an exceptionally righteous woman. And they were unable to have children from one another. They said, we're not really making a contribution to the world as a married couple. Whatever contribution we're making, we could each be making separately. But if we can't raise a family, then as a married couple, we're not making a contribution. So they divorced, and he married a wicked woman. But also Solisa Rosha, and he became wicked like his second wife. She went and married a Rosha. But also Solisa Tzaddik, and she made him into a Tzaddik. What do you learn from there, says the Medrash? You see, from there, it all depends on the woman. The woman determines where a man goes in terms of his own righteousness. So where the righteous man marries a wicked woman, they become wicked. And where the wicked man marries the righteous woman, they become righteous. Does it mean that it's always like that? What does this Medrash mean? What is the Medrash telling us? That the... You got it?
Didn't they say that about Dinah? If she had married Esav, he would have become Tzaddik?
So there's an example that if Dinah would have married Esav, that's one of the claims against Yaakov for withholding Dinah from Esav, that she would have been a great influence on Esav. But why does it work that way around? Why is the woman the one who influences the man? Why is it not the other way around? And what is the Medrash really telling us? Is the Medrash saying that it's always dependent on the woman? Is that what it's really saying? What do you think the Medrash is saying? And how does this link into the earlier Medrash? If it's the woman who can turn the man into a tzaddik, then what's that got to do with the Sotan?
Because she knows how to control it.
So she knows how to manage the sultan because she has a mother. Okay, interesting idea. What else do you think? What is the essence of the sultan? What does sultan mean? Accuses one. Sorry? Yeah, it's a horror. There's certainly an aspect of it, but it's a particular element of the Yetzer Hara. What the sultan really is the power of sensuality. That's what the sultan is. So the woman is the source of sensuality in the relationship. Now that what does that mean as far as the sultan is concerned? Why is that called sultan? Because whenever we see him, that's how he functions. Let's look at the piece that comes next in the whole story with the Nachash. What does he work on? What is he dealing with? The tree looks good. The tree tastes good. He wants a physical relationship with Chava. So whenever you see the Sultan appearing, he works on the human being through sensuality. And through the sensuality, he often causes the human being to deviate, or the man in this case, to deviate from that which the man knows spiritually is what he should be doing. He should be doing from a pure perspective. So let's go a little bit further, deeper than just sensuality. How does the sultan work? What is the power of the sultan? What is the power of the woman? And then we'll work out her strength. Yes, the power of the woman is enticement, seduction, and allure. That's what her power is.
This is such a dangerous line because it's been used to subjugate women, particularly in Christianity and in Islam, however.
And Judaism.
Judaism too, but not.
So, okay, so you've asked an important question. You're saying, let's just be a little careful. If we're going to say that woman is the source of seduction and allure and is the sultan, that would legitimize all sorts of attempts to stifle women and to abuse women and to limit. And yes, and we have to look at that and work out. But let's get there a second. Let's figure out what do we do about this creature called woman after we figured out what she is, what is her power and what is her strength. Because the other thing that we can do one of two things. There might be other solutions too, but let's look at the two obvious solutions. The one is to restrict her and banish her, as the Muslims have done. And the other is, not banish, but certainly restrict and limit her. So she stays at home. If she goes out, she wears all these kinds of things, and she doesn't play a part in public life at all. That's the one route. The other route is to defeminize her. And to diminish the difference between man and woman and thereby remove the magnetism and the attraction, and then she's not dangerous anymore. And here we have to be very careful. And in Yiddishkeit, and certainly in religious circles, we haven't really worked out what to do about women. It used to be easier when society did it for us. So when the norm of society was that the woman was in the background, she was in the home, and she didn't play, then it was easy to be, from the perspective, we didn't have to deal with the issue. And particularly when women weren't that educated, didn't have to deal with the issue. So the women were at home, and that was normal in the secular society as well. The women did dress tzniyas because that's normal in the secular society as well. They were not active in commercial life because that was the norm in secular society as well. But in modern society, that's no longer so. And even in modern Torah society, that's no longer so. So now we've educated women. So women are educated both in Torah and secularly. And we, even within the Torah circles, we've pushed women out into the workplace. And yes, we might say, but you know, it's in the teaching profession, it's in the kind of feminine professions. It doesn't mean that we've necessarily pushed her out into the other professions too. But the pressure of having to earn a living while she supports a man who's learning means that even in religious life, we're pushing the women out. So now what do we do? So there are two, even within religious circles. The one is to defeminize the woman, to desexualize and defeminize the woman and remove her capacity to be alluring. That's the one route. And there are communities that this is not something that anybody's thought out, I don't believe. Nobody said, let's defeminize women so as to remove the satanic aspect of their attractiveness. That wasn't the intention, but it's kind of happened in certain areas and in certain communities. So, for example, when Avelia Lopiad was asked about the custom that women shave their hair, not only cover their hair, but shave their hair, he was outraged at the thought of that. And said, the ways of the Torah are ways of pleasantness. How can you do something that removes the pleasantness and the beauty of a human being in the name of the Torah? How could you do that? But that's a good example of defeminizing the woman. So the one way to say is, the one way to deal with it is to defeminize the woman. The other way to do it is tzniyus. Now tzniyus has been used as a vehicle of defeminization, but that's not its intention. The truth is that the Muslims haven't got it far wrong. The whole essence of the Muslim approach is be a woman and be feminine, and I'm not talking about the treatment of women in certain extreme Muslim societies and countries, but in terms of the woman's role in the family and in society, as you know, underneath those black shrouds and things that they wear, they dress extremely seductively. And in their home, that's how they dress. They wear beautiful jewelry, they wear beautiful clothing, they buy the height of fashion, and as soon as they get home, they take that thing off and they're magnificent. It's just not for anybody else, it's for home. It's in a sense, it's the same way as we are with a woman covering her hair. It's not the and that's the difference between covering hair and removing hair. Removing hair is a defeminization. Covering the hair is using tzniyus. And now comes the question is does tzniyus add to the allure or does it detract from the allure? What does tzniyus do?
One of my teachers, some of you might be, I know you've heard this story earlier, talks about how when he was learning and was at a particular place, and they were talking about that a woman really should be covering up even to her pinky. And I guess he realized this place was not for him, but at that point he was young, and he was thinking, pinky, that's ridiculous. Why is a pinky even the least bit attractive? And then all of a sudden he said he was on the bus, and he kept seeing a woman's pinky. There's a woman's pinky, and all of a sudden he was thinking differently about a woman's pinky, and so in some ways it actually adds to it. And just to bring it to its extreme, one of the biggest problems in those restrictive Muslim societies with their treatment of women, although the way you described it, that's actually the reality of it, is that they have such frustrations. I mean, look at what their ultimate fantasy of dying is. I mean, they are the most
correct.
Repressed.
Okay, it's very repressed.
So it's such an extreme.
That's the big danger. The big danger is that you create repression, and an unnatural society altogether. The issue of women in religious society is probably the most difficult and challenging issue that Jewish religious life has to face right now. And hasn't begun to face it. The idea of tzniut, and I've spoken about that often before. What does the word sanua mean?
Covering.
No, it does not mean covering. Kisui means covering. What does sanua mean?
It
does not mean modesty. No. Not quite. Elior klas tzanua comes lahatsnia. Lahatsnia means to hide. Tzniut means being hidden. Now, when children are playing hide and seek, what's the point of the game?
To be found
is the point. When you hide something, the point is to find it. Does tzniut add earlier or remove earlier?
Well, it depends on what context on the street. In other words, if you're going down Pico Boulevard and you're doing your shopping at the Roman Mart, the people who see you know what you're representing with the tichel on your head, you know, because they're representing what you're representing, they shouldn't be thinking of you in that way. But then, you know, when you go home and you take your tichel off, that's what you're supposed to be, you know, that might be a law, whatever it is, between you and your class.
But then you would be saying that tzniut detracts from it, yeah.
Well, I mean, and then I can just play my own devil's advocate, and on the other side, you know, there's a lot of people that find the allure of a woman that has that modesty and that...
Well, it depends how the modesty is utilized. If the modesty is utilized as a cover-up, then it's not alluring. If the modesty is used as a means of creating, of being hidden, that is alluring.
But isn't the point to not be aware?
Well, not really. Where does it say that?
Not to your husband, but I'm saying...
Even to others. Where does that say... Where does it say that a woman should not be alluring?
I just think taking it back to the whole idea of being created with the satan.
Well, so let's get back to the satan and we'll come back to that. So the satan, the essence of the satan is his allure. Isn't that so? The satan is alluring. Now you can use the power of allure positively and negatively. The power of allure itself is not necessarily a negative. But if you can, using the allure of the senses, can be negative. Obviously it can be negative. It can also be positive. And in a marital relationship it becomes positive. But let's just examine it a little bit further and say, on the question of allure and spirit, is a woman, when she's walking down the street, is it against the principles of tzniut if she is alluring?
It depends on how. I mean, if she's alluring because she carries herself beautifully, and she happens to be a beautiful woman, and maybe she's got a very lovely shape on, I don't think there's anything wrong. She's alluring because she's dressed, you know, provocatively, purposefully provocatively. It's a different kind of alluring, and that's not it.
And what defines the provocative and the alluring? What's the difference?
You are in the eyes of who's looking.
No, not really. What differentiates provocative and allure?
I don't think so. Between when you look at a woman and you say, well, it could be a man, yes, some men dress, supposedly for men dressed in them, not. But if you see a woman and she's dressed beautifully, and she's alluring and she has like a confident air, then when you look at her, it's more about wanting to get to know her to shop. But if you see somebody walking down the street and the first thing you notice is particular body parts, and you...
Okay, suppose then. So what is the difference between those two projections? And so what would be the difference in the way that tzniut is manifest and the way that tzniut is carried out? That would be the difference between whether you're hiding or revealing. If revealing creates provocation, whether it's revealing of bare skin or it's revealing of very revealing of shape, revealing is provocative. Hiding is alluring. There's nowhere in halacha that says a woman should not be alluring. All that it says in halacha is a woman should not be provocative. A woman should not expose herself. It does not say a woman should not be beautifully covered anywhere at all. So in our whole understanding of tzniut, and this is where we have to be so careful that we don't start using tzniut as a tool of defeminizing women rather than feminizing. The whole idea of tzniut is to appeal to the essence of that which the Rebbe Shem created in the creation of Chava. And he created Sotom. She's meant to be alluring. She's meant to drive men crazy. That's what she's meant to do. Now, that doesn't mean she does that in public, but that's her power. That's what she's got to be able to do. And and how much of that is exposed in public, in terms of exposure, obviously, in the literal sense of the word, nothing. And that's why even the pinkies we're talking about, it's not about, the woman's power isn't through exposure. That's not the greatness of the woman's power. The woman's power is through allure. The woman's power is through the creation of attraction. And attraction is not the same as provocation and exposure. And I think you touched on it quite closely. So the one wants you to be, you want to become close to that woman's essence, and the other one is a physical attraction. The one has nothing to do with the specific individuality and uniqueness of that particular person. It's just a male and female animal urge. And if the woman is using that to create attraction, then she's creating attraction, going back to what we said last week, of nefesh chaya to nefesh chaya, then it's animal to animal. That's not what this is about. This is about a specific human being to another specific human being. And the interesting thing about allure is that not everything is alluring to everyone. And that's one of the differences, again, one of the differences between the animal world or the animal part of the world and the human part of the world. The animal part of the world is completely predictable. You know what will stimulate an animal. You know exactly how to do it. So if you're breeding a certain animal, you know how to stimulate their sexual drives. If you want them to eat, you know what kind of food to give them. You can predict an animal's response absolutely. It's mechanical. Now, if a woman dresses in a way that would stimulate any man, that's provocation. That's appealing to the animal part. That's at its basis level. If she's dressed in a way that she is alluring to a certain type of person, and particularly to ultimately when you get to the point where you now to be alluring to one person, that's the ultimate. And when we're talking about the woman, so we're saying the woman introduces into the world the idea of allure. And the idea of allure, what does that do to a man? A man's walking along thinking about his business or a piece of Gemara, and a beautiful woman crosses in front of him. What, and let's say not provocative, just alluring. What happens at that point?
He thinks about sex.
Well, that would be the provocation side, not necessarily the alluring side.
He's distracted.
He's distracted from what?
Whatever he was thinking about.
Which is what?
Or
which is him?
Himself.
So she gets him out of himself. That's her greatest power. In the distraction of ego, and it's so ironic and it's so paradoxical that Sotom, that is the essence of ego, is what can get a man out of his ego. The question is where it goes to, where that relationship goes to, where that interaction goes to, and what happens with him. That's why you've got these two midrashim. The one saying, it's all from the woman. On the one hand, the woman can turn the man into a tzaddik or into a rasha. Why? What is she using? She's using her power of allure. That's what she's using. He's getting out of himself. Now, if he's in ego and he gets out of himself, then he becomes a tzaddik. If he's a tzaddik and he gets out of himself, then he becomes a rasha. Then he gets into ego. She just flips whatever he's in. If he's in ego, she gets him out of ego. If he's not in ego, she gets him into ego. That's the nature of that relationship.
That's the reason that a tzaddik can never be a lord. That's the reason that a tzaddik can or should never be a lord.
Why?
Well, if you're saying that the lord gets him out of himself, then you're saying a tzaddik...
If he's already out of himself,
huh?
You're saying if he is already out of himself, if he's a tzaddik, but he's not in himself, he's not in an ego state, you're right. In the sense, an absolute tzaddik would not be a lord. A person who is completely self-sufficient, there he would be almost getting back to the way Adam was before the separation.
Okay, so an absolute tzaddik would not be a lord because he would have no need.
But if he's a lord, it's only for positive. Like if you take, whatever tzaddik you think of, and you think about their wife, of course the wife is always incredible to Vegas. And when she, so you have to assume that at some point she's a lord in some way. I'm not just talking about relations, but you have to take him out of himself. But it must have always been for the positive.
Yes, but it's a completely, when you get into those levels of tzidkus, their relationship is a completely different relationship. It functions in a completely different way. We'll see a little bit of it with Adam and Chava before the sin, because they were complete tzaddikim. So yes, she's created with the sodom, she's created with the power of Eliyah, and she lands up using the power of Eliyah, and with that there's the downfall of mankind. But in a sense, you're right, an absolute tzaddik is theoretical, because there isn't anybody who is an absolute tzaddik, but if there was an absolute tzaddik, that absolute tzaddik would not be capable of being allured. He would have gone beyond that already.
Okay, can I ask you a question? Because we talk about how women can endure, how can man, but isn't also the opposite true? I mean, so many times in society you see men, regardless of the midrash, you see men influencing a woman for, let's in this case say, for the not good. And it happens so many times where you see a woman who's doing her thing, or she's on a path, and she gets mixed up with some guy, and he leads her astray, or whatever. Is that not the thing?
So how would you understand the Medrash?
The lore that men have as well?
Right, so you're asking an important question. You're saying human experience doesn't support the Medrash.
Okay.
You're saying human experience doesn't support... The Medrash is making a relatively dogmatic statement. Men do this, and women do that, and human experience doesn't support that. So therefore, how would you explain the Medrash? Because that's important. When you see a conflict between human experience and the Torah, you've got to understand that we haven't understood the Torah properly. So how would we understand that what the Medrash is saying then?
Yes, but
the Medrash says it's all after the woman. See, what the Medrash and what this whole piece of Chumash is talking about is not the man prototype and the woman prototype. We're talking about masculinity and femininity. And every man has a degree of femininity and every female has a degree of masculinity. And how much depends on the individual, it varies from in every person. And what we're saying is that the goodness, not just goodness, the direction, the intuitive direction of the couple is determined by the feminine element, not by the masculine element. And what is the difference between the masculine element and the feminine element? What is the masculine element and what is the feminine element in an individual? Well, it's right brain, left brain kind of stuff, isn't it? It's intuition versus analysis. So the male part of the human being gets into an analysis mode and thinking mode, but that doesn't determine choice. Choice is very seldom made out of analysis. Analysis is one of the inputs, but choice is made from intuition, and that's the feminine part. And therefore, at the end of the day, the human being and the couple is going to be led by the feminine elements of being, not by the masculine elements of being. When it comes to action, a man can sit and he can theorize and he can develop all sorts of ideas, but when it comes to making a decision, even an investment decision, he'll often make an investment decision based on a gut feel, not based on the analysis. And and that gut feel is the feminine part of the human being. Warren Buffett's son said that his father sells companies when he gets a pain in his back when he thinks about the company. And so he does it. It's not by looking at the charts and the analyses of the figures and the numbers. He's very intuitive about it. When he gets a pain in his back when he thinks about the company, is that a man or a woman? That's the feminine. That's the feminine part. To be so in touch with your intuition that you can feel and trust that and know that. That's what it's all, when the Medrash says that it all goes after that. But that's also what gets people into trouble. That's also what leads a person to Aveira. Because the sensuality plays into that as well. So the place where you've got the biggest struggle is not in the intellect. And that's why Adam on his own, when man existed in isolation of the feminine force, there wasn't the potential for sin. Because he would figure things out. You analyze, how difficult is it to figure out that something's right or wrong? So especially if you've got the Torah to work with. It's not about whether what we know is right and wrong. Most people know what's right and wrong. You go into a prison and you survey the people there, you'll find they all know what was right and wrong. And they actually knew it before they got themselves into trouble. The reason they're there is not because they didn't figure something out. It's the reason they're there is not because there was something wrong in their analysis. The reason is there is because there was some intuitive force that made them do something greedy or whatever it was, an instinctive force, an intuitive force, that all comes from the feminine side. So when and you remember we did the Balaturim last week, and the Balaturim said the gematria of woman was Nekeva, was Klala. So we get that same kind of being. If there would be no woman in the world, there would be no sin. There would also not be a whole lot of very good things in the world. But man would be so rational and so analytical that the potential for sin wouldn't exist.
But it's also because without woman, there's no relationship. So, I mean, if you don't have a relationship, there can't be.
There's no place for it, yeah.
So it's really the creation of relationship the woman represents. It's not
well, it's relationship. It's relationship and it's sensuality. Because man without woman lives in his head. Not in his senses. Women bring sensuality into his life. All the senses. And that arouses his sensual being, introduces intuition into his own being, which he otherwise wouldn't have, teaches him feeling and emotion, and all of that is critical for his own growth and also the cause for his downfall.
Going back to the Midrash that says that the original Adam was both feminine and masculine, wouldn't that original Adam have the intuition and also...
He would have had it all in one being. So then you've got to ask, then why separate them? So let us go back and write through this piece of Chumash. We're taking the view more that Adam was created of male and female part to start off with and then was separated. So then it seems as if he was really a perfect kind of creature. He had male and female in one, perfectly integrated. And God comes And at that point, no possibility of sin, because they're in one being, and they would have to integrate it properly. So it wasn't one pulling in one direction and one pulling in another direction. Adam would have to develop an integrated view of the world and act accordingly. So that seems ideal. Why does God go and ruin it by separating them? Correct.
That's where the possibility for free choice, if there's such clarity, that the worldview and intellectual, that there isn't the possibility of sin, and then there's therefore no possibility.
Okay, so that's great. So you're saying two things result from having the sensual and the intellectual in two different poles. It doesn't mean that they don't convert, because as we said, everybody has bits of both of them in them, but there's a polarity. There is a feminine force in the world which is primarily sensual and instinctive, and there's a masculine force in the world which is primarily intellectual and analytical, and they work together. But, and without that tension that the two create, you're arguing, there wouldn't be the potential for sin, and there wouldn't be the potential for growth. So God builds the potential for sin in. Okay, so we can understand that. Okay, so now we understand also why the Chazal tell us that Teshuvah was created before the world. What did Teshuvah have to be created before the world for if nobody had sinned? So it was quite clear that God built sin into the design. Sin is not something that we introduced into the world. Adam was the first one who did it, but he didn't design it. It wasn't his invention. The idea of chet was God's invention. The idea of tshuva was God's invention, and that's part of growth. And since the world, we were put here in the world to grow, we've got to, the only way to grow is to get feedback from the mistakes we make. Which means we've got to have capacity to make mistakes. And to have capacity to make mistakes, we've got to have choice. And to have choice, we need these two poles. If everything was absolutely clear and we were working from a black and white, very clear mental view of the world, there wouldn't be the opportunity for error. If there isn't the opportunity for error, we wouldn't feel consequence. If we didn't feel consequence, we wouldn't grow and we wouldn't evolve. What's the other reason that God split man and woman?
Going back to what you originally learned.
Which is?
To create loneliness.
In order to create intimacy, there has to be loneliness. And Hashem wants to create intimacy. And why would Hashem have wanted to create intimacy? Why not leave Adam alone as he was? So he says, Lo tov heyos Adam levad. It's not good for the human being to be on his own. And not to have relationship. Why is that? Why is it not good in the scheme of things?
Because then, in some ways, your personal relationship with Hashem is a certain kind of intimacy that only you have with Hashem. So therefore, the intimacy of understanding how to cleave to something and how to be close to someone, you would never understand how that feeling of that cleaving and that intimacy can help you in many ways, and then translate that to how Hashem
can see. So great. So the one would be is it would make it much harder for us to develop intimacy with Hashem if we didn't have experience of intimacy in our own relationships. What else would there be? What other reasons would there be? Well, the other reason is actually it will drive us. It will give us ambition. Otherwise, we might be very passive. So it causes us to be active. So it creates responsibility. Again, if there wasn't the need for a relationship, then just think what the consequence of that would be. So you know, raising a family, there would be no reason to build homes and businesses and do anything really. You could just sit under the tree and learn. And that is, Hashem wanted Adam to be to some degree driven into action, and Chava is, the woman is what drives man to action. Man is quite capable of living in his head. It's woman and their relationship that compels action, again, bringing to the negative and the positive. If there wasn't action, he wouldn't do anything wrong. But the real reason for the creation of relationship and intimacy, Rashi tells us, in the verses that we're busy with at the moment, chapter 2, verse 18, the Rashi on Ezer Kenegdo. What does Rashi tell us in Ezer Kenegdo is? After the second Rashi in Yud Ches. Ezer Kenegdo, have you got that? Zocho Ezer. Sorry? Zocha, so if he merits it, Ezer, she helps. Lo zocha kenegdo lehilachim, she'll battle him. So why is that so good now? Wouldn't it be better if it was, if that wasn't the case? It's it, well, more than a motivating force. What is it really? It's what, sorry? So she becomes his source of feedback. Otherwise, he gets no feedback. A little while ago, I was visiting somebody in a prison, and he was telling me that when he was in business, if anybody didn't get excited about his ideas, he fired them. And his wife said, "And that's why you're here. Because you couldn't hear anybody say to you, that's not a good idea. You shouldn't be doing that." A man needs feedback. A human being needs feedback. And Hashem creates the intimate relationship as the most accurate, quickest form of feedback. Because when a man gets into ego, what does that do to the relationship? It really hurts. It really hurts the woman when the man gets into ego. And what do people do when they hurt? They yell, they cry, they fight, they do something. They protect themselves. So he gets the feedback that something's wrong. And that's how he builds it. He builds a relationship. It's not good for man to be alone. Remember what Rashi said? Why is it not good for man to be alone? Because they would say there are two gods in the world. Adam's too perfect. That's the whole possibility of ego then becomes, because there's no negative feedback. Adam needs a mirror that can look him in the face and give him the feedback where he can see the moment he's stepping out of line, he gets the feedback. Now imagine if that's the way that the marriage is operated. If a man understood and realized that that's the key role, so how would he interpret when there's an argument? What would be his first reaction if he understood that? What am I doing wrong? And then how would the woman react? Let's say, and even if it's a silly argument, and she's gone overboard for no real reason. So he's home 5 minutes later than he said he would be. And she screams and yells and she goes right off the handle. She just loses it. And he says, "Oh my goodness, I must have done something terribly wrong. Let's figure this out." What's her response? Immediately calms down. The problem's gone. That's it. End of problem. Something wrong. And then she might in fact say, "You know what, in fact it wasn't you, I just had a bad day." And then it's sorted out, finished. The difficulty is simply, in marriage after marriage after marriage, is just not understanding this rashi. Understanding why is she so, then you start saying, why is she acting so irrationally? Where's that putting the blame? On her. So that's, you know, your speedometer hits over 60 and you're saying, why is it going over 60? What's wrong with it? Doesn't it realize I get a fine if I'm going over 60 or over 30 or whatever the speed limit? And you start getting angry at the speedometer. Why is the red light going on to say there's an oil pressure problem? What's wrong with that light? Nothing wrong with the light. There's something wrong with the oil pressure. That's what Chava is created for. There's nothing wrong with her. There's something wrong with you. Now figure it out. Because if you come to that point, even if there is something wrong with her, it will get fixed instantly. Whereas if you get into the mode of what's wrong with the indicator, what's wrong with the speedometer, it's never going to get fixed. And you're going to go faster and faster until you get yourself into a spin and crash. And that's what happens. It's so beautifully laid out. It's so clearly portrayed as to what the issues are and what the essence of it is. And therefore, in the choosing of man and woman, what now becomes critical? Yeah, the degree of the sensitivity of her responsiveness. She's an instrument. She now becomes a feedback instrument. If she's oversensitive to this particular guy, it's not going to work. If she's not sensitive enough, they're not going to grow. So that becomes one of the key things for them to feel out, is what is the degree of sensitivity? Is this the right, is the instrument appropriate for the driver? That's it. If it's an over-instrument, if it's a wild driver, and every time he just moves off a little bit, she explodes, that's not going to work. If he's a very passive kind of guy and she never explodes, then that's also not going to work. And that's one of the things that needs to be figured out. So lo tov heyo sa'odam levada, yes, that's correct. So chava is made as the feedback mechanism, which is the cause of his growth and his sin. That causes destructiveness and it causes growth. And therefore, again, we've got the Medrash saying it all goes after the woman. If she, therefore, is set, if her indicator light is set to tzidkus, to reflect righteousness, she will bring the marriage to righteousness. If it's not set that way, she's going to bring the marriage to negative forces. So let's go a little bit further in the Chumash. So now we're going to start Chof, verse 20. And you'll remember, I'm just going to go through that briefly because we did that already last week. So Vayikra Adam Shemot L'chol Abahim Alof HaShemayim L'chol Chayim. So Adam called them names. He figured out what they were, what their essence was. Ula Adam Lo Yimotza Eze Kenegda, that he could find no human companionship. So he understands that the animal world is not human. Adam, at this stage, you remember the way we learned it based on the Ramban, this was Adam's first choice, not whether to eat from the tree or not. This was Adam's first choice. This was Adam's first test. How do we know it's a test? Because it said that Hashem brought him the animals, Lero is to see what will he call them. So Hashem is watching, he's testing him. What is he going to call them? And if he calls them anything, if he sees... Now, Adam now has a choice. He can be an evolutionist or he can be a creationist. He can say, I'm just a sophisticated animal. I'm just a very evolved animal. Or he could say, I'm divine and they're not. Therefore, there's no way that I can get companionship among them. This is his first choice. In defining the animal world, Adam has to figure out where to place himself, not where to place them. This is not really about naming them. This is really about naming himself. If he looks at the animal world and says, I did not evolve from that. I'm not one of them. They're different. Maybe a part of me evolved from that. Maybe my physical form evolved from that. But I have a neshama. I have a power of speech. I have intellect. I am in a completely different category. And there's no ways that they can ease my loneliness. He had to get to that point first. And you remember we learned last week incorporating the idea of the Klei Yoko, that the human being isn't naturally... a divine being. The human being is created with divine potential and needs to bring that potential to actuality. And therefore, when we're looking for mates or for companions, we also have to be careful to check that the group among which we're looking is a human group, is a group of people who evolved themselves, who have themselves developed, and so on. And that doesn't work by labels, by the way. It doesn't mean that because a person is religious that he's particularly divine. Religious just defines his activities. And that doesn't necessarily mean how evolved is. We have to look at the people we want to associate with. If we want those people to ease our sense of aloneness and our sense of loneliness, we need to look at people and determine whether they're in the same category as we are, whether they and we can form the same grouping, and therefore that there's a possibility of achieving intimacy. And then we remember we learned that the deep sleep that Hashem brought over him, which was, in fact, we said, the Ramban said, was a form of depression. That when he realized, having gone through the entire world of beings, of every creature in the world, he comes to the conclusion, none of these creatures can satisfy my loneliness, he becomes depressed and he goes into deep sleep. And then Hashem takes one of his sides, the Medrash that we've learned, closes the flesh beneath that, Vayiven Hashem in verse 22, Chafbeis. Vayiven Hashem Elokim es Hatzelo asher lokach min ha'odom. And God built the side that he'd taken out of the man, le'isho, into an isho. First time we have that word being used. Vayivieho el ha'odom. And he brought her to the man.
Seems like Adam would be the perfect description of this man-woman community. It seems like, logically, it would have been really cool if this played out in reality. That once Hashem did do that and created the Isha, but suddenly it wasn't Ha'adam anymore. It was...
It's exactly what happens. It's no longer Ha'adam anymore.
But he still says, Yom Ha'adam.
Yes, but look what happens afterwards.
Unless he recognizes it, he's still the man.
In the next, well, let's go to the next verse. Let's look at the next verse. Vayomer ha'adam, and man said, Zos hapam, now I can see. Etzim me'atzomai avosabib, sorry. Now there's somebody who can ease my loneliness. Because this is from my own bone and my own flesh. Lezois yikore isho, ki me ish lukocha zois. Adam creates the terminology. Although God, it says, the Torah says, and he built her into a woman, the word had not yet been used. It's using the word that's going to be used afterwards. The person who coins the word and names them, Adam named all the animals, and he names himself, and he names them. He had named himself already as Adam because of being taken from the earth, but now for the first time, Adam uses the male and female form. And not only does he say, this is a woman, he says, but I am no longer Adam. I am now Ish. It doesn't say ki me odom lukocha zois. Why doesn't he call her Adma? You don't say ki me odom lukocha. No, he says this is weird. That's finished. The Odom era is over. His name is still Odom, but that's not what he is. He's not of the Odom species. His name is Odom, but that's not what he is. He's an Ish. He's no longer an Odom. The Odom is finished. Now Odom has evolved and developed into an Ish and into an Isha. And if you look in the Medrash on Parsha Yudches, it's on the next page of Medrash, if you've got that, the page with a mem on the top. There's just one line of Medrash that I would like you to see. At the beginning of Parsha Yudches, Vayivin Hashem Elokim es Hatzela, Rabbi Eliezer b'shem Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra Omar, Nitan bo bino Yosef min ha'ish. She was given more bina than the man. Where does he get that from? Vayivin, from the word vayivin, which is the same as the word lahavin. Bina is to understand. What does that mean? The woman was given more understanding than a man. A woman gets it much more easily than a man. Bina is just to be able to get it, to be able to understand it. Now, what has that got to do with vayivin? What is building got to do with understanding? Close. You're getting very close. Let's go further than that.
I know. Anna is something that takes into pre-existing inside it. I think inspiration or sort of a creation of ex nihilo, if you call it, is something more manly. Something.
Yeah, I think even further, when you're building, how do you know where to put the next brick? Not really. What do you need while you're building?
Knowledge
of what?
The design.
You've got to see the whole picture. The man just sees there's a brick, there's another brick, he can see where that brick goes, he can see the connection, and he focuses on that connection, he focuses on what he's doing. She sees the picture long before it's there. She can picture the house, and she can see it. A man finds it very difficult to go into a store and choose furniture and drapes and figure out how they're going to look. He can't get it. He can't picture it that way. When it all comes together, he says, gee, that's amazing. Again, it's the feminine in the person and the masculine in the person. Whereas a woman, or the feminine in the human being, is able to do that. She sees the picture. That's what Bino is. Bino is when you get it, when you see the whole picture, and you understand where something fits in. And that's very often why there'll be arguments between a man and a woman. Because a man will be looking at the details of the engineering of a particular little thing, and she's kind of into the whole picture. That's one of the reasons why women don't learn Gemara. Because Gemara gets very tied into the intricacies of the details of minute issues. There is a big picture part of it as well. But the Gemara is really the engineering of each little joint and each little connection of the Torah. rather than the whole picture. And you can spend hours and hours and hours on one small little bit, and a woman sometimes gets very frustrated about that, because if she finds it difficult to see, where does this fit in? Where does this connect? What's this got to do with anything? Why are you spending so much time on this? If she can't see the big picture, she gets incredibly frustrated. The man doesn't matter. He can enjoy himself playing with little things that have no real practical relevance altogether. It's just a completely different kind of a mind. Vayivin, the idea of Vayivin, doesn't say Vayas, it doesn't say Hashem made. Vayivin means he gave her the capacity for building, and the capacity for building is the capacity to understand design, and to understand interrelationships, and to see a whole picture, and where things fit. That's what she's particularly good at. Whereas he's particularly good at the detail. And that's why she becomes the Ezer Kenegdo. Because when he gets locked in and obsessed with detail to feed his ego, she sees the big picture and says, what are you on about? Where is this and why is this so important? Or something is really important. Why are you not giving this the attention that it needs? This is the foundation of the whole design. That's the Ezer Kenegdo. She makes sure that his vision remains in line with the bigger picture and doesn't drift off into some kind of minute detail that doesn't serve the bigger picture. So there we get a bit of a sense of Hashem's intention and how this crazy relationship builds into something that is so elegant and magnificent, without which the human capacity to grow would be completely frustrated.